Welcome back, dear audience, and I think we will continue our deliberations with Ms. Nusha, reflecting on the current women's movement in Iran in the light of the hijab row. Now, when we look at the idea of patriarchy, one of the ways that patriarchy, you know, actually oppresses women is a control over their bodies. And one of the ways to do that is to actually see their bodies as symbols of cultures, communities, even countries and nationhoods. So somewhere along the line, at the center of this debate is hijab, you know. And when we look at from a feminist perspective, you know, as you know, one of my colleagues was sharing with me today, that within the domain of what is called as a woman's right, agency, her bodily autonomy, you know, stripping her of her hijab, you know, against her choice is as much a sign of oppression as it is forcing a woman to wear a hijab. So when we look at the idea of hijab and, you know, and the kind of different contexts within which, you know, it has gained its meaning today, whether it is political or cultural, in fact, it also has historical and geographical contexts. But the most important, you know, way to make sense of hijab, you know, would be within Islam itself. So, Nusha, would you kind of, you know, make our audience a little more aware in terms of understanding, you know, hijab in the larger context, the religious context, the theological context of Islam? And yes, of course, the whole idea is to, you know, how much of a choice and freedom and, you know, within which it can be placed vis-a-vis women. Yeah.
Thank you, Nupur. I would say that in the discussion on hijab, the foundation that I would start with, what I would essentially establish, what I'm about to say on, is that in and of itself, at the end of the day, Islam is a personal choice, and Islam endorses your personal choice to follow it. Or follow whatever religion you want. Islam allows that freedom. So I'm going to base it off of that. Now, building off of that, hijab is a personal choice of a woman. If they want to wear it, they wear it. If they don't, they won't. Don't. How they want to wear it. In what ways that they determine hijab? In what ways do they interpret hijab? Now, the interpretation of hijab, like you said, it varies significantly. It's a contentious subject. I would definitely say that the one element that I definitely agree with, and I just really highlighted there, is that at the end of the day, whether or not a woman wears it or chooses to take it off and keep it off, whether she sees as that mandatory and an important symbol of her faith to her religion, of her devotion, or whether she sees herself as being able to follow Islam without the necessity of the scarf, or whether she interprets Islam in a completely modernized way where hijab is not associated with a covering of your hair. In whatever way, Islam allows women the autonomy to choose how they practice their faith. Now, hijab in and of itself, and I would say, again, there are multiple geographical variations. I'm not going to speak for all of them. I'm not going to speak for other cultures. I'm only going to speak for what I know. And for what I know is the interpretation of hijab among Iranian culture. And Iranian culture, the interpretation is like a gradient. There are two extremes. There's one extreme where it's the full covering. There's the other extreme where it's absolutely no covering. And then we have the different varying levels in between. Now let's begin with we call this the fundamentalist interpretation. So really by the scripture, and by the scripture as it has been, I would say, culturally interpreted throughout the times. So very traditionally interpreted throughout the times. And the fundamentalist perspective of hijab is you need to cover up. No neck, no ears, no hair, right? No ankles, no wrists. That is what hijab is. And if you are a Muslim, you need to cover up. And the reason behind it, the mentality behind it, is a very patriarchal mentality. I'm not going to speak for all. I cannot speak for all. I can only speak up to the extent that I know and I've heard and I've been exposed to women that abide by the fundamentalist interpretation of hijab what I've been exposed to and the women that I've talked to justify it on the basis of male sexuality, male sexual desires. And women take that responsibility upon themselves. And again, it speaks a lot to women, but they take that upon themselves and they say, I will cover up so that the man doesn't sin. I will protect myself and I will protect him, essentially. Because men, I've heard this, and I'm only saying this from what I've heard, but men are weak. Men cannot hold back their sexual desires. So I will not enforce that temptation. Now let's go to the other extreme. The other extreme, there are two. The other extreme one is absolutely no hijab. There's no such thing as hijab. Like, it's just, you don't enforce it. I don't accept it. It's a bad principle. But there's also the more modernized interpretation of hijab. And the modernized interpretation of hijab says that when the Quran talks about covering, when the Quran tells us to cover our beauties or cover those elements of us that really attract attention, it's not talking in a material sense. It's not talking in a physical sense. It doesn't mean your hair or, you know, your other areas, right? It's talking about your behavior and how you conduct yourself and whether you're going to be super loud and rambunctious and grab everybody's attention, or you're going to be more modest, more controlled, more moderate, more humble, right? It's that humility. That modernized interpretation of hijab is really humility. Kind of keeping some of your talents and some of what you have within yourself, because they're your treasures. Don't expose everything, right? So that's really modernist. And then we have the gradient in between. And the gradient in between is a variety of different types of hijab. Some women don't wear the scarf, but they wear very conservative clothing, right? They don't show their legs. They don't show their arms. Some women wear scarves, but they allow themselves to show their forearms. You know, they allow themselves to show their ankles. Some women, you know, in Iran, in order to protest against enforced hijab, they wear it like all the way up to the back, you know, showing their ears. That's a sign of protest. Some women, though, they do show a lot of their hair, but they actually are still trying to wear hijab. And that's the funny thing, just to end it off right there. Iranian style hijab is a very well-known style of hijab, because it's very particular, in which usually there's at least a little bit of a hair that's showing. So generally, you're going to see that among Iranians that either abide by it or don't. But I would definitely end it off and say that is the gradient that exists within Iranian culture.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that made a lot of sense, you know. And at the end of the day, a lot is subject to interpretations, right? Nothing is kind of set in stone. But what really came out from your deliberation is the idea that at the end of the day, it is about personal choice. And therefore, that is very important. Whether a woman chooses to wear or not chooses to wear, it is extremely important from a feminist perspective to respect that and to acknowledge that. And that is why, you know, the whole idea of not just in the context of hijab, but choices in different kinds of spaces, in all the realms that women are, you know, they all become very significant. Now, again, I think I will take you further, because one of the very strong points about having you for the podcast is the fact that you are an Iranian woman, right? And that is something I would say an insider's view. You know, you have a more nuanced understanding, you know, when it's called as a social, political, cultural setting. And therefore, you know, when we look at what is happening in Iran in terms of protests and demonstrations, which actually happened, it seemed that the beginning of those protests were very spontaneous, right? It was at the funeral, you know, of the girl, and, you know, and few women just took off, you know, their hijabs. And then later on, it turned into more creative forms, you know, of singing and of writing and of even, you know, cutting of the hair. So, you know, I would like, you know, you to share with our audience that how do you understand and reflect on this amazing, amazing time, you know, though I would also say that unfortunately, you know, there has also been, you know, violence and also people losing their lives. And I think that is something that should completely be avoided. But yes, I mean, and how do you reflect on this women's movement and the way the protest and demonstrations are happening in Iran today by women?
I would definitely say that a point that you brought up where it appeared to be spontaneous and there was what I would say a trigger of the movement being Mahsa Amini, was it revealed that this wasn't something spontaneous. Not only was it not novel for women to really take up the torch again, but it was a reflection of a lot of built-up tension and a lot of built-up suffering by these women. And just to take you back within the last 10 years, just to give you a brief context of where this built-up tension came from, aside from what I've already told you, essentially, long story short, with imposition of significant amounts of sanctions, the significant sanctions regime that was trying to push Iran into the JCPOA, the most, I would say the people that have seen the most detriment and the most harm from that were women. So from the imposition of that sanction, from the downfall of economy, it was women that lost their job. It was women that were forced back into home. It was women that were exposed to increasing amounts of domestic violence because now it was men that were the main bread makers. And patriarchy really built up. That perspective of patriarchy really built up. And in addition to that, you had a government that was significantly anteing up the anti-Western rhetoric in its propaganda. And it was seeing any sort of movement, any sort of protest by women, knowing that women were one of the main contributors of the 1979 revolution. So the government knows that, right? And knowing that, it attributed any sort of protest by women from the downfall of our economy to them being a political spy, to them being an agent. So women, in addition to all of the suffering that I've already lined out for you, they also saw an increasing amount of political arrests, and those arrests are nightmarish. Political arrests especially involve not just detention, they involve torture, they involve rape as a form of humiliation and taking away a female dignity and pride, essentially. So those women, political, because of the political arrests that they suffered, all of which came from this outside transnational conflict regarding, you know, oil and the nuclear deal and all that, women have been building up a lot of tension from suffering. And Mahsa Amini, and the fact that she was killed because of hijab that wasn't even bad, right? The rhetoric is what was wrong with her hijab. It wasn't even that bad, right? The fact that she was taken in by what is called morality police, the fact that we even have that, right? The fact that she was taken in because this amount of hair was shown and she was killed for it, that was a trigger. And women said, enough is enough. We have had it. No more. And from that, within Iran, what you saw was an incredible feminist movement. And the feminist movement essentially was incredible because it wasn't just women, right? As much as we focus on the women on the Western side, so here on the outside, we're really focusing on the women. But in Iran, you're seeing that level of equality that feminism really tries to achieve. I mean, the feminism that I see, feminism has multiple different renditions. I'm not going to speak for all of them. But in my interpretation of feminism, there was a significant level of equality. Men saw women and women saw men. So the slogan, and it's a very, very beautiful one, is Zan Zendigi Azadi, which means women, life, freedom, and Mard Mihan Abadi, which means men, prosperity, and I'm sorry, I forgot the other one. It's a very complex type of Persian. But essentially, women were calling the men were calling the women. And it was a very, very integrated movement for all. So that was what was happening within Iran. The gender binaries were supporting each other. There was that level of equality. Both were fighting for each other, right? It wasn't women saying, women, life, freedom, men, you have to say women, life, freedom. Women were saying, you say women, life, freedom, but I will also say men, prosperity, and peace, right? So that was what was happening within Iran. Outside of Iran, what is occurring outside of Iran, I can't say was. It still is. It's still ongoing. It's very painful. But outside of Iran, we're seeing a significant amount of support from the Iranian diaspora across the globe. you know, even across the globe, multiple people are coming out with their own experiences, with their own traumas, with their own pains at the hands of this regime, what they have also suffered, right? These people, they're out of the country, but that doesn't minimize what they've gone through. And what they've gone through is just as legitimate, is just as valid as the people inside Iran. Now, what was happening, however, and I don't see that anymore. I can't speak for now because the rhetoric has changed. The rhetoric has changed from a feminist movement to a complete different conversation, right? We're not talking about just reform anymore. We're talking, I mean, they're calling it a revolution, and we're going to respect that. People in Iran are calling it a revolution. If they call it a revolution, we will call it a revolution because they're the ones fighting this. However, what we saw in the beginning when it was just the feminist movement was a little bit of a mix of Western perspectives on feminism and Western interpretations of feminism on people in Iran. Now, this is important, Nupur, because something that we fail to recognize is the propaganda within Iran. So the government, the biggest tool that the government has is its propaganda. And as much as we see people on the streets right now, I can guarantee you at least 50%, I would say two-thirds, I would argue two-thirds of Iran are still in their houses. And they're still on the sidelines. They're still, we call them gray zone. They're gray zone because they're good people. They're gray zone because they have stuck with the regime, not because of the regime in and of itself, but because they believe that in doing so, they are protecting, they're being patriotic, and they're protecting their national Iran, their cultural Iran, their Islamic Iran. And this perspective has been maintained by propaganda enforced by the regime. And what's been going on, as sad as it is that sometimes some of the Western movements in support of Iran, there have been, I would say, imposition of Western perspectives or ideologies within the Iranian movement. And as much as I support it, and I think it is up to Iran, the country, to develop culturally in whatever it wants, in whatever way it wants that level. I think we should give Iran that agency and that autonomy to really develop those understandings and those perspectives in the way that it sees fit according to its culture. What the government did from these types of moves and acts from the West was it would take these moves, it would spotlight it, and it would show it back to those gray zone conservative people. And it would say, you see, this movement isn't for you. This movement is a threat on what you want. This movement is a threat on your religion. It's a threat on your culture. It's a threat. These people don't want Iran. These people want to bring the West into Iran, right? And these gray zone people that saw the deaths on one side and they really care, and they're moved by the deaths, they're moved by the killings, they're moved by all the funerals. These people care, they're good people, are pulled back by this type of propaganda because they've been living by this type of propaganda since the 80s. So you can imagine what position these people are in and how nuanced and how careful we have to be in the West as well about how we approach this movement.
Okay, yeah, I think those were very, very significant points. So, for the audience, if we can just kind of summarize, there are three broad arguments that came out very lucidly in your discussion. First, of course, that we have moved beyond just a feminist movement, a women's movement. And here we are looking at, as you would say, they want to use the term revolution. And also women and men both have come together now. So that kind of gender binary or gender hierarchy is not there, and there is more solidarity that one can see, you know, with men and women coming together, to protest. The other thing is in looking in terms of intersectionality, which is also that here now we are not looking at just one particular category of people in Iran, but we are also looking at other kind of, identities, other kind of regional and cultural identities within Iran, right? And therefore, that is something which is also kind of enriching the entire discourse there. And then third point is something which is a very significant question within feminist discourse. And that is the whole idea of reclaiming what is called as indigenous feminism, cultural feminism, to be able to go beyond the Eurocentric idea of feminism and to reclaim certain kind of indigenous cultural form of feminism. And that is also a challenge, which has came out from your discussion, that women in Iran are trying to do that the whole Eurocentric interpretation you know, and be able to claim what is called as one's own voice, one's own idea of freedom, one's own idea of liberty, one's own idea of, you know, women's liberation or women's empowerment. I think those own, you know, indigenous definitions, which are emerging from one's own subjectivity situated within the cultural, socio-political context, is something which is also important and also a challenge, right? Because at this point, the world is watching, you know, and there are numerous, as you're saying, there are numerous ways to understand it. So thank you so much, Nusha, for bringing out those nuances. You know, as I said, it is something that perhaps you could have, do it better than anyone else, you know, because you know it, immersed in that cultural, scenario. And then finally, when we look at, because one of the things which is very central to our podcast is trying to make sense of gender-based violence, right? And, there are certain norms and certain ideas of defining masculinity and femininity within the structure of patriarchy, right? And women and men, and I always say men as well. So both men and women who do not kind of fall in those, you know, those parameters, they face violence, you know, and it could range. It could be from what is called as everyday forms of violence to more specific and also visible forms of violence. So, and as you just suggest, you also kind of pointed out that one of the impact has been, again, a counter violence that, that women are facing, in the form of political protests and so on. So now, how do you see it moving ahead? What change do you think? Do you think that it will just die down, and perhaps, it will continue the way it is? Or do you think that something very significant has happened now and it cannot go back? So how do you kind of analyze it and foresee in terms of future, for women in Iran now?
I mean, it's more so what I hope to see, but in regards to one of your questions, I definitely think that there's no going back. From this, the exposure of this protest, what we have been seeing coming out, for example, of the UN Human Rights Commission recently, where they voted in favor of an investigation into the human rights crimes of Iran, all of those are really going to put everything out on the table. But in addition to that, social media has been absolutely indispensable to this movement. And because of social media, every single death has been our death, right? Every single brother lost. I mean, there was a little boy, Abulfaz. That boy was like my brother. I feel like I lost my brother, right? Kian Pirfalak, a week ago, Sipper, these boys, these girls, Nika, right? All of these individuals that have been lost because of social media, their deaths have become all of our deaths. And because of the amount of pain and the amount of trauma that we have seen in the past few months, and the impact that all of this has had on everybody's awareness of the future around AC, I can't see this going back. Even if this, unfortunately, and I genuinely hope it doesn't, but even if it does end up dying down now, this isn't the end. And the one thing that we need to realize is, I would say the most significant thing that came out of this was the youth that came out, because those youth, those school-age children, those are the adults of tomorrow. So you may be able to stop people now. You may be able to enforce power now, but those youth are the society of tomorrow. And if they're standing up right now at this stage, I cannot see us going backwards in time. I can only see us going forwards in time. And in the regards to the future, I hope to see both sides of the spectrum coming together and realizing that what we want is the same thing, right? Right now, there's a lot of distrust. There's a lot of fracture. they, you know, on the one end, they don't know if by supporting this, they're going to have to sacrifice their Islamic cultural roots. On the other end, they don't know if by supporting the other side, they're going to be associating themselves with the regime, right? So is a regime supporter the enemy, or is it just the regime? So there's a lot of distrust. There's a lot of fracture. But I think that what I hope to see is that everybody come to the realization that what we all want is a free Iran where everybody can live in the way that they want within the cultural, within the rich culture and nationality. The rich, I would say, Islamic culture. You can't ignore that. It's there, right? We absolutely cannot ignore it. And it would be very wrong. If we ignore it, we're going backwards in time. We're just repeating history. So I would say that what I hope to see is I hope to see that unity between both ends. And I hope to see the growth of Iran, that independent, cultural, Islamically, culturally rich Iran that women were fighting for 100 years ago, and they're still fighting for now.
Okay, thank you so much, Nusha. I think today was a very rich and engaging and very optimistic discussion that we had. On that note of solidarity, hope, and a lot of strength, you know, to women of Iran, I think I thank you. I thank you on behalf of my audience here. And I thank you on behalf of Collaborative Social Change. I think one of the objectives of Collaborative Social Change here is that, you know, you are there and I'm here in India, and both of us could actually engage in this conversation. And we have our audience who is listening to us from different parts of the world to be able to have a deeper understanding, a more nuanced understanding of women's issues, nuanced understanding of these protests and these demonstrations, and what do they mean to women of Iran. I think that was my purpose, you know, of having you on this podcast today. Thank you so much, and have a good day. And again, thank you to the audience. Thank you, everyone, you know, for this patient hearing. Thank you.